Activation.
Okay, so welcome to the day after NeurIPS.
2 days then your deadline.
What?
8 a.m. right?
8 a.m. today. Welcome to the hour after NeurIPS. You probably didn't submit to it because, oh, you submitted, but you're still like vertical.
Barely.
Even though I just selected this chair, you know. Get into the mood.
So, yeah, remind me that we're going to do some upgrades of computers and stuff today, which is the day after
Okay.
deadline to do that. Maybe today,
Maybe.
maybe. But we'll do this kind of thing. But what I want to do is I want to introduce Constanza, who is finishing her PhD and looking for a postdoctoral home. She's a little bit interviewing us to see if this would be a good place to hang out. And so, but she did a bunch of work during her PhD is very interesting, including a bunch of work on factual recall, but also a bunch of other interesting topics that you should ask her about while she's here. You're here for a couple more weeks, right?
Yeah, until the end of the month.
Yeah, that's right. So she'll be hanging out here, and you should look to her as a resource. But I'm really looking forward to hearing this work. I chatted with Costanza a little bit yesterday, and even though I feel like her perspective is that this work is sort of wrapped up and ready to present and everything, I look at it and I think, oh, there's a lot of interesting things in here that continue to open up interesting questions. And so I'm looking forward to hearing your presentation. So let's see if I can. I'm gonna try click around here to clean up this presentation here so that we can see the good slides.
Yeah, thanks for the presentation and thanks for having me. Super excited. Yeah, I was telling Poyena earlier this week that I seen like a lot of work that I liked in coming from Davis Lab, and that's why I decided I wanted to come and visit and meet some of you in person and yeah, have like discussions and yeah, get to see how the group works a bit and all that. So today I'm going to present you a bit of two recent papers, or sort of recent. And so the talk is titled Understanding Factual Knowledge in Language Models, Multilingual Knowledge and Epistemological Implications. And just like before we start, just telling a bit about myself. I come from Chile in South America. I grew up there and I did my undergrad at the University of Chile. And right after graduating, I moved to Paris, working as a software engineer at YouTube. And during my time there, like we worked on the engineering side of like scaling thousands of different classifiers and machine learning models and how to like evaluate and maintain all these models and make sure that they continue to be as good over time, and how can we automate things and do not make mistakes. But yeah, after a couple of years, I decided I wanted to start a PhD. So I quit my job and moved to Copenhagen where I started my PhD with Anders Søgaard at the University of Copenhagen. And yeah, I know I'm kind of like finishing probably. Yeah, just trying to get to start writing the thesis, and then I'll be done. Right, so my interest is like pretty broad in interoperability. I really like interested in all things that allow us to understand how a model makes its predictions. And during my PhD, I have done a few works related to factual knowledge and trying to understand how the model stores and retrieves factual knowledge. But yeah, I've also done like a few other things now in factual knowledge. Right, so today's talk is gonna be about these two papers. And we're gonna first start with how do multilingual language models remember facts. If at any point you wanna comment on something, or yeah, just like ask any questions, feel free to interrupt me. So in this work, we looked at three questions. So first, we wanted to see if like the localizations that have been found for English models would extend to multilingual models, and whether these localizations would be the same across the different languages. And then the second question, pretty similar, but in terms of information flow. So the information that is flowing from the context to the last token and how that works for English models, do we see the same kind of patterns in multilingual models? And then the last bit is, okay, understanding like how the things that we know extend or not to multilingual models, where in this recall process, does language play a role? The first two parts of the work, of like the first two questions, really kind of like extend the work from previous papers to multilingual models, and we directly compare to their findings. So one of those works is from this group, the Rome paper, and the other one is from Morgeva, dissecting recall of factual associations. Right, so just a bit about the experimental setup. We do kind of like the same thing that people have been doing for really looking at simple factual recall. So we have fact triples of subject, relation, and object, and you have like natural templates that describe this. So here the example is Barack Obama was born in, and then you feed that to your model and you see if the model predicts Honolulu or Hawaii, and then you say that, yeah, the model knows that. We use the Emperor data set, which contains 45 languages and 37 different of these relations. So born in, capital, I don't know, language spoken, and so on. And these were machine translated from English templates. And in this paper, we study 12 different languages, and we study three different models. Two models are the coder only, XGLM and UrLLM. And we also study an encoder decoder model, MT5, to kind of like see, yeah, kind of what differences do we see for different architectures, and also with a model that covers a lot more languages.
I have a question. Is there fact triplets like from the same language? So you have multiple languages, you have 12 language. When you construct a fact triplets, do you keep subject, object, relation, object from the same language, or you mix it up?
So you mean in the input, whether it's, yeah, the input is always like the same language. So everything was translated, like the entity, the subject, for example, was translated using Wikidata, so that you get the way that people would say it in Chinese, and you use that with the Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, you are doing it with a multilingual language model. Mm-hmm. So it can be that like you have your subject from Chinese, your relation from English, your object from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Does the model understand that?
Right, right, yeah. That's definitely something interesting, but we don't really look at that in this paper. I would imagine it works, and it would be interesting actually for maybe trying to understand from where the model gets the language. We're gonna touch upon that a little bit, but yeah, good point. Right, so then we take this, yeah, go ahead.
Can I ask a question about these models? So what makes them, like, is it just that they just pre-train on a bunch more languages? Is that like the main difference?
Yeah, between good point. So yeah, we actually picked these languages because we really wanted to focus on the multilingual side of things, because we could have like picked, I don't know, like Llama, which is like a lot more studied by people, but Llama was like mostly trained in English and just a little bit of other languages. And so the model would probably work differently. And we wanted to understand like the multilingual setup of things. So that's why we picked these languages, which do a bit of bigger effort to train or like to sample more the rest of the languages. Other differences between them is like EuroLM is much newer model. It came out last year or like at the end of last year, and XGLM is a lot older. XGLM had a more aggressive sampling, more like uniform across the languages. So it was like really trying to be more multilingual. EuroLM does it, but then it has like some parts in the training where it's like we put more English because we have a lot of English data. And so they still had a lot of the other languages, but to a lesser extent. And then yeah, MT5 has a lot more languages, but it's also a smaller model.
Thanks.
Yeah, and so then we take that data, we generate with each of the models, and we just do 3D decoding. We allow for like multiple tokens in our generation, and then we do exact matching. We try to like use different aliases of the object, so different ways of expressing the same object, so that we can really try and match as many examples as we have as we can. And then we just do yeah the exact matching. If there are like extra tokens that were generated, because maybe like in some languages you have the template Barack Obama was born in, and then the model adds like some articles or something extra, we then add that to our example. So then in the subsequent analysis, always the next token is the first token of the object. And with that, we have this number of examples that were correctly predicted by each model in each language. We omit these languages from the rest of the analysis and the averages that we take, just because they have like too few examples and they tend to be more noisy in the results.
Yeah,
And
the idea why Japanese is so bad.
why Japanese is so bad? Well, some if I think XGLM didn't even have it in the training data. We decided on the 12 languages to have like a broad kind of like different scripts, different language families, and different ways to construct a sentence. But then yeah, XGLM say older, and they didn't add Japanese. Sometimes even if they didn't add the language, the models are still okay, and that's why we still tested it. But yeah, it's just so it's just
But
really bad.
even in MT5, it's bad.
Yeah, but it's like in MT5 it's like yeah, it's the worst, but
That's
but
understandable.
it's like kind of
Yeah.
near the others. And we see that MT5 has like a lot more, like a better distributed, a better distribution
Yeah.
of the memorized facts. Okay, no worries. Yeah, and yeah, we see that EuroLM is a bit more skewed. But yeah, that's what it is. But it's still decent, more or less, for the other languages. Right, so then we're gonna use this only this like subset of memorized examples for all the other analysis. And so the first thing that we did was to kind of like run the localization causal tracing to see if things are looking the same or not, or whether yeah, what will we find? And I just like added a few details. Like we use like for each language at most 1,000 examples. If we have more, we just like discard it because it is pretty expensive to run. We restore around 12% of layers for we restore windows of 12% of consecutive layers of MLPs and attention layers, and we measure same as like following the Brown paper the recovered score, so the score that you get when you patch minus the score that you get in the noisy run.
What does restore means?
Yeah, so it's so in the causal tracing setup, you first you have like the the sentence that we had before, Barack Obama was born in, and you add noise to the tokens of Barack Obama, so the subject, and then you perform that inference, and you're gonna get something more noisy, right? You're kind of like breaking this inference, and then you run it again adding noise to the subject, but then you restore in some specific component, say the layer 12, I'm gonna put back what like the activations that I had in the in a normal run, in a run with no noise. And so by patching that, you see, okay, how much am I recovering by that restoration? And then in the plots that I'm showing in a minute, we're looking at logits because we kind of like looked at probabilities and logits, and probabilities tend to underestimate some components a little bit, but they're not all that different anyways. So first, just for comparison and as a background, we have GPT-2, which is the English model mostly studied in previous works looking at factual recall. And we get these results. So in these plots, we have in the x-axis, we have aggregations of tokens. So tokens before the subject, the first subject token, mid-subject tokens, the last subject token, the first after, and yeah, all at the bottom, we have like the last token. And then on the x-axis, you have the layers, and this will show like each of the restorations that we do. For the MLPs and attention, we do restorations in patches of windows. And for the state, it's just at each layer. And yeah, like the main kind of like findings in the first part of the run paper were, okay, we see this early site in the MLPs. And then there's also like this late site, which is mostly driven by the self-attention.
What is all search of the last subject? Is that all subject?
Yes, all. But, so all, yeah, like all the subject tokens.
But why don't you see, where you see the last subject, like MLP is firing on the last subject, mm-hmm. but don't see when you patch for all subjects? That's a little bit.
So no, this is not, so the patching is, it's always done like in, it's always the same. The y-axis is just how we aggregate for the plot. So basically in here the all subject tokens will be just the average of,
okay, so
of looking
at
all
like
these things.
Tunes down.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of like tunes down.
Exactly, yeah, like because that. You're averaging with the first and the middle subject token.
Okay. And the other thing is that what's the difference between all after subject and after subject last?
It's kind of like I should have probably that's a good point. Like I should have maybe cleaned this because when I plotted it was like more for us to like look at what was happening. So all after the subject tokens, like again, all the subjects that come after the subject, just like averaged. And
all the subjects.
Like if anything that comes after the subject. All those tokens.
Like just, everything after the subject.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then after the subject. So yeah, in this case these two are the same.
Like all after subject and after subject last?
Yeah. So we should to be more clear, the second to last should have been removed because it's
But in the figure it's different.
It's like the last two are the same.
Okay.
I have another question.
Yeah.
Do you think is there a effect of the context window of the model in this analysis you're doing?
Yeah, totally. Like it is.
It's like, dependent because that's why you have the
and like
in the last one.
Yeah, like can you say again the last part?
So basically, when you're passing your input stream, so it looks like it's mostly kind of doing something for the last piece of text you're passing in. Is that what's happening or?
So what I wanted to say about the window, yeah, sure. Like this is completely dependent on the window. Like if you pick like any kind of like distorts the things a bit, right? Because maybe here we're looking at this and this still has some effect, but maybe there is no effect there. But since we're doing a window, the effect is just coming from the earlier layers and the layers just before, and that layer have no effect, but then we're still taking a bit of the effect that's coming from before. And so, yeah, if you do like a smaller window, then it would be more specific, but then that also means that maybe just replacing one MLP is not enough to really see a change on, yeah, on the output.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so then here we have the two decoder-only models, so UrLLM and XLM, and we kind of like see similar patterns. We see in UrLLM, we see the early side in MLPs pretty clearly. In XLM, we don't see it. And that kind of like might be because of the window. You could have tried like a higher, like a bigger window. I think we did, but still like it was pretty, like a lot lower than the other models.
Those are the auto.
Yes, auto regressive models. Yeah. And then we see in both the late side, and we do see that the MLPs seem to be more causally relevant for this prediction than they were in GPT. And this will, afterwards, we're going to have like more evidence about the prominence of the MLPs. And then for MT5, here, yeah, the plot could be a bit confusing. So in the x-axis, again, it's like the aggregation of tokens. In this first rows, we have the encoder tokens, and then the last rows are tokens that are part of the decoder. And then we see, again, the MLPs causal, like the early side, but here we see it like pretty constant in all the encoder layers. So like it kind of like doesn't matter where you patch back in the middle or at the end, like it's pretty much the same. And we also see that the first subject token, it's still relevant. Like the last subject token has more relevance, but yeah, the first one is more than in the ultra regressive models. And yeah, and then we see the late side again is like a bit shared between MLPs and the cross attention. And we also see it that the cross attention is like later, almost like glass layers, compared to what we're seeing before. Yeah. So what we see from the causal tracing, just like summing it up a bit, in terms of the early side, we see that in the decoder only models pretty much extends to what we had seen in English GPT. And in encoder decoder, we see that both the first and last subject seem to be relevant, and it covers all the encoder layers. In terms of the late side, we see a bit more relevance of the MLPs compared to just the attentions in English models. Right, so moving into the section, or like the second question that I mentioned at the beginning, so the information flow in this section. So before it was mostly like just looking at places, right? Like which components seem to be useful, but we don't really know for what or like what exactly they're doing. So in this section, we follow and kind of like study this three-step process that Geva described in the paper, where for English models, they see that first, the relation flows to the last token. So the information about the relation flows to the last token. Then on a later stage, the subject flows to the last token. And finally, the object is resolved by attention lake. So we want to see kind of like, do these three steps also happen, and to what extent in multilingual models? So, first, we ran like the attention knockout experiment, which you want to see how information is flowing to the last token. So what you do is you mask the attention from the last token to some set of tokens in the input. So at layer 10, you don't allow the attention to look at the subject tokens, or you don't allow the attention to look at the non-subject tokens and you see what happens with the probability. And we then measure the probability change. So P tilde is the probability that we obtain when we knock out the attention, and we subtract the original probability of the predicted token. And again, we're doing this intervention in windows, right? In here, we follow the same window that Geva used, so we knock out around 18% of the layers.
This is a point of information. So when the knockout happens, does it happen like everything before the point you choose cannot be looked at, or just that particular spot?
Yeah, so we knock out exactly like subject tokens. So if you have tokens that happen before the subject, the last token will be able to look at those, but just not to the subject tokens. Okay. So like everything before, everything after.
Everything after.
Yeah.
Just and, like a black yeah. spot.
Yeah, exactly. So here we have the results. The colors are a bit bad, but in gray, we have GPT. And first, let's look at the left figure, which is knocking out the subject tokens. And here we see, we can, no worries. Here we see that in all models, we have this big drop.
That's right.
In like the later layers, around like 60%, 80% of the layers, all the models have like this big drop if you don't allow it to look at the subject tokens. And we see that MT5 is like slightly later. So in terms of looking at the subject, we see that in all of this happen kind of like the same. But then for the non-subject tokens, which would encode the relation and whatever else is needed, we see that for GPT, like it has like a big drop at the beginning, but then increases pretty linearly. And then when it's looking like at the subject, like around layer 60 to 80%, this drop is not all that high. It's like minus 20% as opposed to the minus 60% of the subject. In contrast, the multilingual models have like a lot more drop in the non-subject tokens. And like in MT5 and EuroLM, we really see there's like a big drop at the beginning, and then even like another drop at the same moment that is looking at the subject. And then in XLM, there's like a huge drop at the beginning, and then it grows linearly, but still like when it's looking at the subject, the drop of masking the non-subject token is still pretty big, and even bigger than those of the subject. And this is the same plot, but just for EuroLM and divided by languages. And this kind of like show us that the trend that we see is consistent for each of the languages. So basically the model is doing the same for each of the languages with a bit of differences here and there, but more or less the same trend. And so from this part, we see, as I just said, that we have similar information flow across languages. In terms of the subject flow, similar than English GPT, there's like this late stage where the model is really looking at the subject tokens. In terms of the relation flow, we do not see that this flowing of information really precedes the subject. It seems that the non-subject tokens are like attended all throughout the layers. And yeah, that's like probably the language is like coming in some part of that. And we'll look at that in the last experiment. And so now we're gonna look at the third step described in the Geva's paper. So they saw that the object extraction is mostly performed by attention layers. And so to kind of analyze that part, what we do is we do a vocabulary projection from the contributions of the MLPs and attentions, and we check if at that point, the top one token from that vocabulary prediction is the same that was predicted, or that is predicted. And if it's the same, then we kind of like say, okay, this is an extraction event. This MLP is really pushing for that token to be in the top. And yeah, and then we measure how many of these extraction events happen.
Do you measure this by feeding it through the language modeling hat, or?
Yeah. So,
but that one is not good at decoding the language from the middle layers.
Right. And that's kind of like the assumption of, yeah, but but the thing is, when we're looking at the object extraction, it's what's happening at the end, right? It's the kind of like the late side that you see in the
council
analysis.
Not that multilingual, because this could be a name. This could be Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's not even really multilingual.
You mean that
the Barack token doesn't change?
Yeah, but like some component has to push the actual language-specific token to be at the end, right?
Are there language-specific continuations as well?
What do you mean?
Well, are all subject predicate objects of the form that subject and object are names, or are there also other things?
So, yeah, there are always objects are entities, but the entities can have different expressions, like in different languages, they're not all the same.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. So this is for comparison, this is the plot for GPT. So what we have is like how many extraction we see for like all our examples, how many extraction events. And in green, we have attention models, and in purple, MLPs. And from here and like some other extra experiments, the main conclusion was, okay, this is like really done by the attention layers. When we look at
what were you extracting?
Yeah, so it's like we are not extracting. We, in a way, it's called like the extraction rate, as in like the model is extracting at that point the object that it wants to predict.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because yeah.
How does that metric work again? Like,
so for each example,
yeah,
we do that. Like one MLP, we project it to the vocal with the language model head, and we see if the top one token is the same that is predicted at the end. If it is, then we count it as one.
Okay.
If not, it's zero.
You should try to rerun this with the pet scope
and
or something.
How?
Because I mean, I don't know. GPT is a tool. It, I guess, it will just decode to English. No.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these results are just with English examples, right? This is just for comparison.
Yeah,
in like,
that's fine.
Yeah, it's like this is what happens for English. Let's now see what happens in the other languages with the other models.
So, in some sense, if you can extract the top one token within some intermediate layers, would that suggest that the later layers are absolutely unnecessary? I mean, if your extraction rate is like 200%.
Well, not necessarily, because it's like, okay, yeah, maybe like in layer 20, one attention layer was like, yeah, this is the token, and like putting that into the residual stream, but that's not enough to like really move the residual stream to that token. There has to be like a lot of additions of the same thing to then for that representation to be really close to that token.
Then the solution can be that, well, top one accuracy is a really, really hard metric. Right?
Yeah.
You can for sure.
Tougher. Like it could be that some are also extracting, but by just having it in the top two.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like a hard metric to really say, okay, this component is really pushing for that token.
It can be like multiple attention heads. They kind of like contribute towards that token, but when you kind of like consider their single contribution, it's kind of like not enough to push that token like up to the very top.
Yeah. So, yeah, and to be honest, like when you look at it per language, because Here I only have like the average across languages. Like in some languages, you do see extraction rates that are much lower.
Mm-hmm.
And that is probably that, yeah, those tokens are still like pushed by these components, but not in the top one, but maybe in the top two, but then that aggregates at the end still. Right, so these are the plots for the multilingual models with the multilingual data, average across languages. And here we see that for both the autoregressive models, the MLPs seem to be a lot more prominent in this extraction event. Like they are also adding, and even more than the attentions, the tokens that should be predicted.
But the y-axis is on a different scale here.
Yeah, it's like
0.2 and not 0.3.
Yeah, but what I'm comparing is like between like the two components. Just saying that, like here we have the MLP is like as much
if the difference is smaller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like exactly.
The relative. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. In MT5 though, we see a more similar trend to like English GPT, where the cross attentions are really doing like most of the job, and the MLPs to a lesser extent. So just like adding to this, that I think that's interesting because in a way it's like when you look at in the causal analysis, when you look at the late side, you're like, well, yeah, that's kind of like expected. Like at some point, the if you just replace two with the correct token, then you would restore everything. But I think for the multilingual setup, it's interesting because at some point, if you have like more general representations, at some point you have to decide in which language you're gonna say it and how it's like said in that language. And then we see that for doing that, attentions on itself are not like enough, and the model needs the MLPs to add the specific language form. Right, so onto the last part of the paper, which is like, okay, now we kind of like have an idea. Things more or less, we know that the model is like looking at the subject at the end. It's looking at not subject tokens all around, but we're not sure like in which part looks at the relation, which part looks at the language, and how do these two relate to each other. So we look at that now by doing activation patching. And so the setup is we have in blue one inference pass, and we do it in English. So we have FAT in English. And then we take the last token representation and we replace it into the inference pass of another language FAT. And then we see what happens in terms of probability, prediction, and so on. And we do this in three different setups. So first we look at, first off, facts that share the same language, so English, the two of them, but they have a different relation and a different subject. So in this example, one is the relation of capital and the other one is language, and one subject is France and the other one is Germany. The second setup that we look at is same relation, but different language and different subjects. So the subjects are France and Germany, and both have the capital of those. And yeah, one is in this example, one is in English and the other one is Spanish. And then the third setup is same subject, but different language and relation. So in the example, we have the subject in both is France, but one is the capital and the other one is the language. We only experiment with patching from English into other languages just because of time. But it would be interesting to see if this really extends to other languages. Right, so with the first setup, we will really be able to tell when the relation flows to the last token. Then with the second setup, even though we have the same relation but different languages, we're going to be able to look at when the language flows. And then lastly, by having the third setup, we're going to be able to see whether the language and relation are entangled. So the first setup, we have the patch and context are in English, and then we patch layer by layer and see what happens. And what we see, this is for the three different models, is that when we patch pretty late, so in blue, we basically, the patch already contains the object. And so we get Paris. Here we're looking at the histogram of the token that we get in the output. So if we patch too late, we obtain Paris. So we obtain the answer for the patch example. If we patch really early, we don't really, the patch doesn't have much information, and so we obtain a lot of times just German, which is the answer from the context example. But then in between, we see that we obtain the answer with the relation from the patch. So the patch contains a relation, but it attends to the subject in the context, right? And so we obtain Berlin, which is the capital of Germany. And so this plot really tells us that in purple is the places where the last token already contains a relation. Before that, doesn't yet. And so right before that purple is when the relation flows. And that's kind of like what we were seeing from the information flow, the like big drop at the beginning, right? That's the point where the relation is flowing. Then in the second setup, where we have same relation, but different languages, we see these plots where we're counting the number of times that we obtain the object from the context, but in the language of the patch. So in this example is the times that we would obtain Berlin, so the capital of Germany, but expressed in English. So we're obtaining the answer for the context, but in the language of the patch. So what we see is that around these layers, the last token already has in its representation which relation should be extracted and in which language. So basically it defined what it should do in English, but then it does it in whatever other language is in the context.
So you never see Paris.
Yeah, so this is one of, so there is a table in the paper where we kind of like measure how many times we see the opposite, right? And it's like really like a few times, like five or
very low.
Yeah. And most of those examples are a bit noisy. Like the five is like really sometimes zero, in the sense that to match, to really say, okay, this is the object from the context in the language of the patch, we have to like constrain a lot of things. For example, we need to constrain that both of the objects are expressed in different ways, because if both of the objects are spelled the same in both languages, then we cannot know in which, whether it's the language of the patch or the language of the context. And then other times, like maybe the object is tokenized in like multiple tokens, and the beginning is just like a T, and then can we really say like which of the two is or not? And so there are like a few constraints to like, here we really measure when we're sure that that's happening.
Right. So your, okay. So your conclusion from this is that there's a, this patch at layer, you know, 23 mm-hmm. or whatever, right? It contains information of what language you're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Without containing any information about what the attribute is
exactly yeah.
that you're trying to utter.
Yeah.
And that it's clearly after the attribute has already been figured out.
Yeah.
So there's almost no interference.
Yeah.
There. It's like a very, very clean I mean, it's kind of a remarkably clean separation.
Yeah, yeah. Sense. Yeah.
The 2022 paper. Oh. When did you publish this?
Last year, end of last year.
This is
I wonder cool. whether we cite you guys, because it's so similar to what we did.
Are you familiar with Chris's?
I think it's the one from the ICML workshop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think maybe our order was different.
Yeah, I think.
Look at the same
yeah, thing, it was kind of like on the time that I was finished up yeah. this experiment.
Cite each other.
but I, one thing that I thought it was like in contrast, but okay, maybe I'll finish with the other experiment and then I'll comment this
yeah, sure.
to not like make it confusing. But I'll come back to that. Right, so then in the third experiment, we have the same subject. And because here we see that the last token encodes both what should be extracted, like the relation, and in which language. But then the question is like, okay, then are those two things entangled together, the relation and the language? And so with this setup, we're able to see that for the decoder-only models, that is not the case. For MT5, I can comment on that in a bit, but it's a bit more difficult to really conclude on it. So for these two models, in these layers, we obtain the object from the patch, but in the language of the context. So basically, the last token already contains the relation. Well, already contains the relation, but not yet the language. So the language is attended like after this. And because we're obtaining, like in this example, we're obtaining Paris, which is the capital that is the relation of the patch, but in the language of the context. And so putting that together and doing a bit of normalization, so the three curves are like in the same scale, we see this like two-step function for these two models, which is like in green, the last token has the representation. And then in purple, the last token now also has the language that should be answered. And then in blue is when this function is like applied to the context, and then you get the object that is at the end predicted. And what I wanted to comment about that paper is that setup was like a translation task. And so,
fantastic.
Yeah, and so because the language is the main thing that is happening, you see that the language is encoded at the beginning. And so you say like, okay, the language that should be outputted is encoded pretty early. But then the way I see it is like, it's not the language that is encoded early, it's the task. Like, what should I do that is encoded early, which is what we see here as being the relation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why do you call it two-step function?
Because you have like these two stages where the model creates this function. And you can, with the experiments, you can see that you can take like what you have until like just having the relation, and then the model is still able to like grab the language, aggregate it into that, and then really apply this function. Because yeah, it's like, I got a function because it doesn't contain information yet about the object.
Have you tried to patch like different things in like two different layers at the same time so that you can maybe further verify like it's a two-step processing?
But how would you do so? Like what exactly do you want to look at?
For example, you can try to like patch some like the language or the relation thing, you know, earlier layer, and then mm-hmm. patch the maybe the subject or in the later layer, like patch two things
mm-hmm.
and see what happens in different cases, like if you patch something early, something late, and something else earlier and something else later.
Yeah, I didn't try it, but in a way, like always I was like thinking about it, like, yeah, could I like kind of control for everything? I want you to output in this language, this relation, and kind of like steer them all. But I didn't try it just because I was always like a bit doubtful whether it would work, whether I would like completely break it or not. But yeah, that's something that one could try. Yeah.
Could you just say again, like green, purple, blue, like what would be an example of like
that? Yeah. So in here, I'm kind of like just putting it together, these three plots. So the blue is like from the first experiment. So the same blue that we have here. And then this is the purple. So from the second experiment is where we see that we have both the relation and the language. And then the green is this plot. So I'm just like putting them together so we can see that those things that are happening in different layers.
So green is only
relation.
Relation.
Yeah.
Purple is relation and language.
Yeah.
Blue is like
the object is there. So the function was like applied right here, kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how are you making these pairs of languages? You're just coming up with them?
Yeah, that's a good point. In the review process, I was not clear enough at some point. And yeah, basically like in the data set, we have the relation kind of ID of each example. And then we also have the subject's IDs and the object's ID. And so we match them across languages. We're like, okay, for the same, I'm gonna take like, yeah, this subject ID, I want other relations that also contain this subject, and then I obtain those relations, and then I match them up, kind of like with the data. But that also means that we kind of like have like around 1,000 examples, more or less, like something 800. It's not that much as we had previously because we're doing this match to really follow the settings that we want in each experiment.
I think these plots would be much easier to read if you would put one example onto the slides or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm just seeing LP or
yeah. Here. Yeah, it's like coming from before, but it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point, thanks. Right, so to conclude a bit on this part, we saw that we have like similar overall patterns and information flows across languages. So for different languages, the models are doing pretty much the same. We also saw that English decoder-only findings mostly extend to multilingual decoder-only models, and there are like a few nuances with encoder-decoder. We saw that the late side is present in both MLPs and attention layers when we're looking at multilingual models. And we saw that both in the causal tracing and then in the extraction rates. And then in terms of the relation flow, with the information flow, with the attention knockout, we couldn't really see where the relation was flowing, but then with the patching, we really got a better understanding. And then finally, we're able to observe this two-step function that is happening in decoder-only models, where first the relation is encoded, then the language, to then finally apply this function to the context. So just to like a bit of like in the general, okay, going away from the details exactly, but looking in general about the recall process, we see that the function in the last token is formed in stages. And I think it would be interesting to see like if it happens in general, like other setups that are not like recalling and multilinguality, and whether that extends to like more complex task solving or not. Then we see that the function works in context in different languages. So we form this function from English, and then we could apply it to context in other languages. So this function is pretty multilingual, or like it works in different languages. And then lastly, yeah, we see that the multilingual extraction uses both MLPs and attention layers. And I wonder if this has like any implications to like if you want to edit knowledge in multilingual models, should you also like edit these later MLPs? Are they needed if you want to do that or not? Yeah. So
okay. since so some comments and questions and suggestions and so on, just on this first paper. So it's very nice story about multilingual factual recall, and you began with this nice performance plot of how different languages have different mm-hmm. levels of accuracy, and yet so if I were to anthropomorphize, you know, the mechanism you found here, to me it looks like first you do this language independent recall mm-hmm. of the fact it's brought to the last token, and then somewhere around layer 28 it says, oh my gosh, I have to answer in German, and then it activates the final MLPs and says, you know, how do I say this in German,
mm-hmm.
and then activates some MLPs or something to put it, this, you know, multilingual concept into the German form, right? And so if that's the mechanism, then you would imagine that if a model knows a fact in one language, then it would know that fact in all languages the same, because that first phase seems like it's multilingual, it seems mm-hmm. like it's shared, and yet you have this very different performance.
Yeah. So yeah, like this is one story of what's happening, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But the fact that we find this happening doesn't mean that it happens for all the facts, right?
Right.
Like it could be some other facts where we don't find this, right? Like we don't see this.
And, exactly. So yeah. I guess my question would be, is it possible to like go from the understanding of this mechanism to maybe a new version of that performance chart where you say, oh, actually, you know, in Korean, which has like a lower performance number for a bunch of these things, it's, you know, like 30% of the time, for whatever reason, when it's working in Korean, it actually doesn't know the fact, like it doesn't have a representation that ends up at the last token. If I patch it into English, it doesn't work
mm-hmm.
for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Korean, like the factual recall is broken 30% of the time, but maybe 70% of the time, it like the fact is there, but it doesn't know how to utter it in Korean. It doesn't mm-hmm. it fails to translate it yeah. into Korean or something like it seems like it might be the possible.
The fact pathway is there, but yeah. like it's not.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it might be possible to go from the aggregate end-to-end benchmark. Mm-hmm. that everybody reports
mm-hmm.
to now a more fine-grained benchmark, which says, oh, actually, you know, patching allows me to more fine-grained diagnose like where the performance flaws are.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that, and then maybe build a stronger intuition of like what's missing in Korean versus what's missing in Russian.
Mm-hmm.
It might be that you have different languages that have different kinds of things missing. It might mm-hmm. suggest that you need to do different types of adjustments to your training data. You know, mm-hmm. it seems like there's like you're very, very close to mm-hmm. this
yeah.
interesting
yeah, that's a good point.
Diagnose.
That's a good point. Yeah. At some point I was like discouraging myself from doing that, just because I was like, will that be like an interesting story if I just tell you, well, for some languages the model fails because it fails in some, it fails in this step one, in some it fails in step two, and then you're like, well that was obvious.
So then so what,
but,
right?
But then yeah, so I think the point is like maybe for some languages it fails more in like one or the other. Maybe yeah. you could try and fix yeah. like one of the two. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm very interested in this, you know, some of the students are interested in the model editing techniques let's like do a little bit more training to improve mm-hmm. the model's knowledge or to change the model's knowledge or something like this. And it seems like there's always this old question of like, oh, you know, you have this insight about the mechanism. So what, you know, what's, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. who cares, right? Okay, now you're smarter. Okay. But it seems like you've got this really nice setting where you have relatively low actual recall performance in a bunch mm-hmm. of languages. People do care about this kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And yet we don't know like what kind of fine tuning or what kind of adjustment you would do to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's this opportunity to a very cool paper saying, oh, there's two different types of mitigations depending on the situation that you're in. And, you know, develop like a little experience of like, if you fine tune in this way, it mitigates problem B. You fine tune in that way, it mitigates problem A.
Right.
Don't spend your effort on the wrong thing. After you've debugged it, you can see what's going wrong. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
It'll be interesting.
It would be cool if you could hard code it.
Or can you work tweak the LM head to kind of like do this thing that you're suggesting?
Oh, like come up with a new architecture?
Yeah, I mean, the fact is there. I mean, the pathway is there. You're saying suggesting that it's not strongly activated for all cases. That's why it's not getting translated into the performance.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what the right mitigation would be for all these things. Mm-hmm. I think that would like sort of suggesting, you know, could be future research. I have no idea what would work.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just looking now at the time.
Are we already over?
Yeah, so I'm just gonna say one sentence about the other paper. And
I wanted to hear about the other paper. Oh my gosh, what is it? Bridging epistemology.
Yeah, so in this paper, was a collaboration with some philosophers, and we interpret.
Show us some slides.
So I can give you a bit of the motivation. So we were like, well, we talk a lot about a lot of times, like the model knows this, the model doesn't know this, but what do we really mean? And like, when does the model really know a fact or not? And so like in the previous work and in a lot of works, if the model can correctly predict Dante was born in, then we say, okay, the model knows. But then, people were like, well, but if I say it in a different way, the model doesn't seem to know, to really know the fact because it doesn't say it correctly. And then more recently, people were like, well, but what about related facts? If the model really knew that Dante was born in Florence, it should also know the nationality, right? And so in this paper, we look at the question of like, yeah, what are the sufficient and necessary conditions that we should set to say, okay, the model knows this fact? I can show three more slides. And we resort to philosophers and to philosophy because philosophers have like a big history of thinking about these questions, thinking about beliefs, thinking about knowledge for humans and what it means to say someone knows. And we focus only like propositional knowledge, so knowledge of the form X subject knows a proposition. There are like other types of knowledge, such as like knowing how to ride a bike, but this is just like about propositional knowledge. And yeah, so to really answer this question, the design answer is like, well, it depends, right? Philosophers have like different views on how we would define this. And what we do in the paper is we look at five of the most popular definitions of knowledge in humans, and we interpret them in the context of language models. And we draw connections to current research in NLP and knowledge. And after doing that and discussing like which definition would imply what and how we would implement them. In terms of the implementations, I quickly gonna say that it depends on the current methodologies. Like in the paper, we quickly like touch upon some methodologies for some of these definitions, but really some definitions do not yet have the necessary methodologies. I could talk for like too long to describe each of the methodology, the definitions, but we can.
Why don't you flip through the rest of the slides and then we
can. Yeah, okay.
You don't have to explain them all. Just flip through them visually.
I think one thing that is interesting is like getting the sense of that the first definition from Sarwell is like the more basic one. So you say that you know a fact if the proposition is true and you believe it. So I believe that the capital of Germany is Hamburg, but it's not. So I cannot be said to know that the capital of Germany. But if I believe that the capital of Germany is Berlin, and it actually is, then I know the capital of Germany. In this definition, there's like this belief class, because Sarwell bases this definition on a really strong definition of belief. Like, you have to have a consistent system of belief. You cannot just like randomly believe that this road is called, I don't know, Hamilton. Because it, like, you would have to have other related beliefs to that to really believe that. But then the other like really popular strand is coming from Nozick, which is like, okay, let's not put so much let's not use like a so strong definition of belief, but rather let's add the condition of having a justification. So you believe that the capital of Germany is Berlin, and you believe that because you saw it in a textbook, because you went to Germany and learned that, and you have a justification to believe in that. And that is also true. But then, and yeah, I'll add this. That definition has like some problems that philosophers like to think about edge cases. So it's like a bit of an edge case. So we have John, who's looking in the field and say, and then he sees a sheep, and then he's like, oh, I know there is a sheep in the field, because, and he has a justification. He's like, well, yeah, I've seen a lot of sheep in my life. This looks exactly like one, white, fluffy. I know it's a sheep. But then it turns out that it's not really a sheep, it's a dog. So we wouldn't be able to say that he knows there's a sheep in the field, because the proposition is false. It's false. But in reality, there is a sheep in the field. It's just obscured from his view. And so given Nozick's definition, we would say that John knows there is a sheep in the field, because he believes it, he has a justification for it, and the proposition is true. But it feels a bit incorrect, right? Because he has a justification not connected to like the real proposition. And that's where like other definitions come in, where in this one, Sepsky tries to solve these cases by saying that knowledge only comes as a result of people acting virtuously. So you only can know things that are a result of virtuous acts. So acts that would have the truth on like its like most priority. And this is like one definition where it's not really like 100% clear how you would do that for language models. And I think it would be interesting that if you could like have some sort of understanding of what's happening to be able to say, okay, in this case, the model was really like, I don't know, recalling all the facts about this entity and actually using that and doing the mechanism truthfully, rather than just, okay, I don't really know anything about this, what can I connect it to it, and try to set some separations. Then Austin is like pretty similar to the first definition from Sarwell, but instead of like being so strong about the belief definition, he takes a more pragmatic view and is like, okay, you don't have to be consistent with everything that is related, but just with things that are relevant in this context. So things that facilitate you in this context. And then lastly, something that goes like to in a completely different direction, Williamson points out that people have been trying for a long time to define conditions or other things that could accumulate to knowledge. So how can we like dissect knowledge to really be able to say that we know? So belief plus justification plus other facts and so on. And then Williamson is like, but what if knowledge is the atomic thing? What if we cannot really separate knowledge, but we can understand all the other concepts in terms of knowledge? So basically his view is like, we would say that you would believe something if you act as if you know it. So belief would be defined in terms of knowledge.
How is it different from the fourth one? I mean, it's facilitating correct prediction.
So the fourth one is more like the first one in the sense that it's it's really having like a consistent system of belief, because if it facilitates correct predictions, it means that for you believing this, it entails that other beliefs that are related are also useful. Whereas like the fifth one is like, we cannot talk about beliefs as an ingredient of knowledge, but rather knowledge is an ingredient of all the other things. And that one is kind of, again, it's like a bit useless in the current state of things, but it could be potentially useful if you're able in a way to define like a knowledge box kind of thing, or like where is knowledge in my model. Or for example, when there was like this recent paper that they train probes to extract knowledge from internal representations. And so they say, okay, I'm able to extract this knowledge, but the model never generates it. Should I say that the model knows that or not? If the model never generates a fact, but I am able to get it from the representations. And for those sort of questions, then you would pick like a bit of a definition like the fifth one and saying, okay, if it's there, then the model knows it. And that also becomes relevant when you think about tasks like unlearning. If I train my model to forget a fact, if my model doesn't generate it anymore, does it not know it? But if it's still in there, like in the early layers, it kind of feels that it still knows the fact if I just remove these later layers that are just subtracting it from it. Anyways, then in the paper, we also have a survey where we ask philosophers and computer scientists if we can even say that language models know, if knowing is really a human thing or not. And yeah, we can comment on that at some other point, so we don't run more over time. So I'm just gonna.
Wait, no, but what was the verdict?
What was it? What?
Verdict.
The conclusion.
Yes, conclusion. Yeah.
Of the paper. Well, the conclusion is this nice figure. yeah. So it's like, just like, it would be nice to take a bit of inspiration from these definitions from coming from philosophy to evaluate knowledge maybe in a more, how to say, like, complete way, and to really talk about knowledge when we want to say something stronger than just outputting something. Or maybe you want to do that, but being specific about that. We just did that in the previous paper. So, yeah. So, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Hi, Constanza. Can you hear me? Oh. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Great talk. I really enjoyed it. I have a question about your last work that you presented. If you can repeat the name of the paper, if you already published it.
Yes. The names of the papers are just here.
Defining knowledge. Thank you. I find it. Thank you.
Really, we should just memorize Constanza's name.
It's a bit of a long name. But yeah.
Do you think this probing way is the way to find knowledge in language models, or is there a better way?
That's an interesting question. So I think that there's always like this problem of like, if you can extract it, is it really there, or did you learn, or like, did your probe learn it, kind of thing? Like,
if it's not there, how did the probe learn it?
Because you're giving data to the probe to learn that, to learn to extract, right? And so, in a way, you would have to prove that the model would use that that connection, that like connection between the relation and the subject in other contexts. Maybe it never generates it, but it's still able to use it, say, for a to-hop fact, or it's still able to use it for another question. And then I would say, yeah, the model knows that. Like, it's using it for other things.
So you're suggesting we do perturbation after we figure out some like knowledge concepts through these probes.
But it's still pretty, it is a kind of like a challenging setup, right? To how to do it and
yeah.
and how to like be really sure that it's there and then the model is using it.
Got it.
How distributed is knowledge in the models?
Yeah, that's something that we were discussing the other day. We see that it is pretty distributed, and like this results don't really show it because we're using like same type of templates where we always show the entity directly. But then if you have like say, and we kind of like see it sometimes, like if you look at say like the localization plots, the causal analysis for each of the languages.
So you localize across MLP
mm-hmm.
output vectors and attention head outputs.
Yeah. So what I wanted to say was like really simple that
yeah.
for some so other languages than English, the tokenization of the subjects tend to be much longer.
Sure.
Just because it's like in a different language, and so. English sometimes will be one token, or a lot of times it will be one token, while in other languages it's like 3, 5. And so I think that that's related to the fact that we see in the causal analysis for different languages that the MLP's early side kind of like moves a little bit. In some languages it's like a bit longer than in others. And there are other works that look at two hub relations. And then when you have like the place of birth of I don't know the spouse of Michelle Obama was, then the model has to connect like all the Michelle Obama get to like a representation of Barack Obama, and the model actually does that, and then that happens like later in the layers, and so the model needs to have still that knowledge in later MLPs to be able to connect it and still predict it. So all that to say that yes, it is pretty distributed along like different layers because the model may need it at different stages, depending on how the input is.
I hadn't thought about that. The multilingual setting is a really excellent setting for multi-token rollout. And we've been trying to understand, you know, the mechanisms of multi-token mm-hmm. output. But wow, I think it's pretty interesting. Because it's very controllable, switch languages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I want to ask, like, you mentioned, like, different aspects of knowledge. Like, have you tried to, like, take a look at, does different aspects of knowledge processed in different part of the models? Like, maybe some part of the model are more about, like, whether the model believes it is true or not, mm-hmm. or, and then the other part may contains more information about, like, what's the evidence of it and how it can be can use for like make correct predictions
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Yeah, I haven't done it. In I think it's an interesting point to like try to understand whether the model kind of like encodes a little bit its own uncertainty about the knowledge. And there was a paper from Ferrando that where they try to see if they find like an sparse autoencoder direction that would encode the whether the model knows this entity or not. Like if I recognize it, then I'm less uncertain about whatever I predict of this entity. And they show that they're able to find this direction and play around with it a little bit. And I think that goes in that direction, whether
yeah.
the model has like beliefs and really with quote unquote, because I'm not sure what we would say a belief in the model is, but
yeah, that's interesting.
Whether
I can ask about the name of the paper later.
It starts with do I know this entity and then something.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Can you always track back a knowledge item to a parameter or a set of parameters in the model, or are there effects that only form in the residual stream by adding a bunch of things together or something weird like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that's a good question.
Jared, did you have a question?
Oh yeah, I just wanted to bring up about like, I guess one type of knowledge that I was wondering your thoughts on is like, there's like a paper about like, I think it was, I'm not sure if it was just in linguistics, but like, if you ask like a language model or like a human to like do some sort of like linguistic classification task, the model is like not very good at outputting, you know, like the right answer or whatever. But actually, like when you look at its like probabilities for like sentences like that, it clearly does encode that like grammatical concept, if that makes sense. So like if I ask someone who's never learned about parts of speech or whatever, like they would intuitively like, because they can speak the language, they know, they obviously have that knowledge, but they can't actually like articulate or output it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering like how that fits into like the sort of just
That's an interesting setup. It's like we were discussing that the other day with David on like, yeah, the information is there, but you haven't really trained your model to decode that. And it in a way, it's like what I feel like happens in this like later stage, the model is decoding to each language, and to be able to perform that, you would have to like include in your data a way for the model to learn to decode that and train and like edit some of the later layers to be able to decode it into natural language. And like in the analogy, like asking a person that doesn't know about grammar, what is the subject here? They're like, okay, I know how to speak, but what is a subject?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I wonder if that would be more like knowledge of how to do something rather than knowledge of like compositional.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's definitely like a know-how, right? Like,
right.
Yeah.
It's something like it does not believe anything, but it facilitates predictions.
Yeah, but that's the distinction is that that falls into like another category of definitions of knowledge, which is then knowing how, which is not the ones that we look in this next paper.
Looks like we have an online question from Pranav. Pranav, do you want to?
Yeah, so I was thinking about these ReLU like highway connections. Thought about like designing models where you have these highway like connections from early layers to later layers. And these redundant connections between different layers, and then if that changes where the different language fact representations arise.
So you're saying that connections between different layers could change the representation of language?
Yes, yes. So for example, like in vision models, sometimes people have these highway connections going from early layers to later layers, mm-hmm. and that overcomes the vanishing gradient problem for the early layers. So they also end up like capturing like very like important features for like final stage classification. So the classification of from like early layers also improves if you want to decode the object category. And I was wondering like if for these concepts across the different language representation that you're getting might get fine-tuned if you allow for these. Mm-hmm. Highway network, highway connections to exist.
Yeah, I'm not sure what exactly would entail as I've mostly just like train and play around with the transformer, but that's a good point. Like maybe you could train the model to like really ignore the language and just like look at it at the end, because you will be able to still look at the. At the beginning, by having like this direct connection, and that could be an option.
So, thanks very much, Costanza.
Yeah.
So let's take a little break. I think we have another, visiting speaker soon. So, but thanks very much.
Thank you.
And you can ask Costanza more about. This work, I'm sorry we didn't have enough time to talk.
No, about the philosophy work. Sorry for taking so long.